So welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod,
episode 34.
So 34 episodes.
It's not bad, is it?
When we set off on this in August, crikey, what was it, 22, whenever it was, would we ever have thought we'd have done 34 episodes?
No, it could have very easily been one of those things that we did for two or three,
yeah,
and then it sort of tailed off, but... You can now, actually, if you wanted to binge listen to our podcast, listen to one every single day, and it will take you more than a month, which is not bad.
I like that. I like that fact.
And we are getting quite close to a 50th anniversary.
Yeah, we're going to do something
50th
big.
50th episode.
I don't know what it's going to be, but we'll do something big for our 50th.
Something fun, I reckon.
Yeah, something fun.
But this is very much your episode, and it's something a little bit different to our normal format.
It is a little bit different. We normally do a species or a, you know, something.
Sort of a single topic that we focus on, yeah. Whereas this one's just a little bit more conceptual.
Yeah, I read a book.
And that is pretty much the story of this episode. His dad has managed to read a book.
I read a book, and it's one of the most inspirational books I've ever read, and it's by, she's a world-famous naturalist now, by Dr. Jane Goodall, who I think you have some knowledge of anyway.
Yeah,
don't you?
I remember seeing her in a couple of documentaries. Obviously, she's well known for work with chimpanzees, and I'm pretty sure those were sort of that's the focus of the documentaries that I've seen her on. But that was from a long time ago. More than anything, I've just followed her on Twitter for ages. Like I say, big name in conservation.
I've
followed her for a long time.
Yeah,
now.
She's a big name in. I mean, they called her on the back of the book. Actually, it says the world's most famous living naturalist. So,
she will be pretty close to sort of David Attenborough.
Well,
I think,
yeah, it's
most,
a big statement.
Yeah,
but she's an amazing lady, and the book. I think the book is called The Book of Hope, and I think the book resonated with me so much is because in all of our episodes, if you've listened to them, any of our episodes, we do have a little format to our episodes where we talk about. Normally, it's about a threatened species or something to do with climate change or whatever, and. We start off focusing on the bad stuff, but in every single episode, we talk about hope, and we talk about there is hope for this species, and there is hope for this, you know, climate and environment amazing people. Normally,
yeah, I was going to say we always try and highlight the people that sort of spark that hope, because whatever the species is that we've covered, there's always an organisation or a group of dedicated people who have made it their life's work to. Try and bring them back or save them. It's probably quite good timing because we struggled with positive stuff at the end of the krill
episode.
Yeah,
we really did, so. Actually. I think that was probably the only episode we've ever had where we struggled to find some hope.
So what I think probably happened is we did that and then Dad's just had to go looking for some sort of hope.
Well, what I really like about this book is the whole book just concentrates on hope. And although obviously she structures, you know, the things that are going on around the world... and that's the focus of the hope. But she sort of splits the book into four reasons for hope. And every one of those chapters is a bit like every ending of our episode. So that's why I really like it, because every chapter is just full of hope. So, and some amazing stories as well. And I'm not going to go through and sort of list every example and every story.
This is actually an audiobook. Dad's just going to sit there and read.
But we are going to... structure the episode today on those, on her four reasons for hope. But just a little bit first, I guess, about who Jane Goodall actually is. I mean, she started off as a very young age with an interest in all things animal and animals and the environment and the world. But she, I guess, her fame came out of studying chimpanzees, and she became one of the first people to really study chimpanzee groups and families and challenged the ideas that people had of how intelligent, I guess, animals were and whether they had a structured life like we do, and discovered all sorts of things, realised that they use tools, realised that they use an intellect very similar to ours in the way they structure their lives. And she changed people's perception of animals, particularly chimpanzees, and her concentration is still... on protecting the chimpanzees. But she also, which I didn't realise, became the first person ever to be accepted into a chimpanzee group.
Yeah, I think there's a very famous photograph of her having a hug with one
of
them, isn't there?
That was a really famous photograph, yeah. And again, I could talk probably for the whole episode about her work with chimpanzees, but we're not going to
do
that.
As always, we'll stick links so yeah. people can go and find out more about her work. And...
But she's an amazing lady. She's 60 years now of changing people's perception of animals, sentient animals, campaigning tirelessly for a more sort of enlightened attitude towards animals and the environment as well. And
yeah, she's... just to add to that, so you said 60 years of work, she's actually 90.
She's now 90. She's 90 this year. She's a UN Messenger of Peace. She became a Dame in 2004. And she is an incredible, inspirational lady. And she... I think I'm even bypassing any catch-up. We'll just carry on.
As always, I've not got any anyway.
Yeah, so I've only got a little bit. And I'm just going to carry on and talk about Jane Goodall and this book. So she talks about the four reasons that she has hope.
Like the four pillars. The or four I think pillars. Actually I don't know whether she said that in the book. I haven't read the book yet. I will do.
And we're going to chat about each one and give a few little examples. And I think you've got some... Yeah. Examples that aren't in the book. I'm going to sort of highlight some of the a couple of that she's mentioned in the book, which I found incredible.
And yeah, because you rang me at the sort of beginning of the week with this yeah. with this idea, and you've got a few of the stuff, like you said, that's from within the book, and then you sent me the four reasons yeah. or four pillars of hope, and then I've taken them, interpreted them. I don't know whether the same or slightly different, and found some examples from outside the book that yeah. I think sort of highlight what's going on in the world that I don't know maybe fits into those categories.
Yeah. So the four reasons of hope that she has are, one, the amazing human intellect, and two, the resilience of nature, three, the power of young people, and then four, the indomitable human spirit. Those are her four reasons for hope. And in her book, each chapter is those four reasons, and she gives some fantastic examples of why she thinks, for example, the amazing human intellect will ultimately be a reason for saving and restoring some of the damage that that amazing human intellect
has actually caused.
So there are some contradictions there, which she talks about. But so I wanted to do first, and I realise I'm talking rather a lot here.
This is your episode because you've read the book.
And... is that she does a chapter all about what hope actually is. And... she makes a real point of saying that hope isn't just sitting there hoping something will happen. Hope will only, if you hope climate change will, you know, we will
solve
climate change, it'll only change if you take action.
Well, it's like
you it's no good sitting there saying, she made a reference of saying, I hope this will be a good book. But she knew it wouldn't be a good book unless she took action and worked really hard at it. So it's what keeps us going in the face of adversity. It's what we desire to happen, but it'll only happen if we work hard and make it happen.
It's like, I hope we'll make it to 50 episodes of the podcast, yeah. but that will only happen if yeah. we continue to work to put out episodes of yeah. the podcast.
So that's how she defines hope. And then she starts off this book with talking about the amazing human intellect and how that has developed and separated us from the rest of the animal kingdom.
Yeah, which is interesting because I think from a very brief chat that we've had pre-starting the recording, I've interpreted the human intellect slightly differently, and I've brought some slightly different examples than the way she's gone yeah. into it in the book.
Yeah.
So I think if you want to kick off with how she delves into the human intellect, and yeah. then I'll bring some left-wing examples.
So she defines... throughout history, our intellect, which she defines as the part of our brain that reasons and solves problems, and that part of her brain has developed far more than that of other animals. Even when Homo sapiens separated from, you know, the great apes, I guess, and is that right? Is that
yeah? So
that evolutionary,
essentially, yeah. So obviously, we're closest. Related to chimpanzees yeah. being the bonobos and the chimps. Yeah. And then I think if you go back, you've got the other great apes being the orangutans and the gorillas yeah. that we share a common ancestor with slightly further back than we do with
and
the
we're
chimpanzees.
We're very close in sharing most of the DNA with those.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember the timeline, but the most common ancestor that we share with chimpanzees is really not a million miles away. That branch is pretty close as far as the evolutionary time scales go.
Yeah. So Homo sapiens developed this this ability to reason and solve problems. And then the big thing that separates us from them, although they have a language, is language and the ability for us to make conscious decisions and understand each other and build agreements and communicate. And that's one of the big parts of our intellect. She also makes a point of saying you have to remember that intellectual does not necessarily mean intelligent, because an intelligent animal wouldn't necessarily destroy its own habitat.
Yeah.
Like, of course,
we have.
We've been doing for a long, long time. So I guess then, you know, she talks about the fact that intellect has created incredible innovation and technology for both the preservation and the destruction of human life,
yeah,
actually. So because of that amazing human intellect and ability to communicate, that is her hope for the fact that we will eventually realise that we have to get together and communicate.
We are sort of in this together.
We're in it together, and that level of communication is what will ultimately help us save and restore the damage that we've done to this planet.
Just have to hope that we do it quick enough.
But we have to hope that we have to take action,
yeah,
quick enough and do it. So she then goes on to talk about the way that amazing intellect has to be used to restore the damage that we've done. And again, there are four sections to that, which I thought was really interesting. But the big one is that she says, and we've talked about this actually before, in respect of the rainforest destruction, and we've talked about those people are often destroying the rainforest because they need an income and they need a living and they're feeding their families.
And yeah, and the change needs to come from the higher level. Really.
So the big thing is that we have to alleviate poverty, because if you're living in crippling poverty, you will cut down that last tree, you will fish that last fish to feed your family. So we have to alleviate poverty around the world, because then people won't have to take such drastic action and destroy the environment around them just to live. So the next thing is that we have to reduce the unsustainable lifestyles that we all lead.
I've got some stuff about that.
And it again, concentrated on the sort of sheer selfish greed for profit and gain and big corporations and wealth and power of individuals, and we have to change that. We also have to eliminate corruption within government.
That's a tricky one.
Yeah, because only honest leadership can, you know, help solve social and environmental problems. Only honest government can do that.
When we think of all the stuff you said leading up to that, where we need change from the above down. So if we want to, you know, create new ways for people to earn money, we need the infrastructure to be there for those industries to actually work. That will only come from the people in power willing to make those changes.
And again, we've talked about that a lot, where we think,
like the ecotourism, you know, and things like
we think ultimately only governments can change law, only governments really, as much as, you know, you can campaign to your heart's content, but it's only government that can stop water companies tipping sewage into the sea.
Yeah, but without the campaigning, putting pressure on them.
Oh, absolutely. No,
so
absolutely.
You need the pressure.
You do need the pressure.
There's no way they'll do it out of the goodness of their heart.
No, of course. But ultimately, it's governments that change laws. So
it's just up to us to make them.
And then the last thing is that we have to face up to the problems of population, of humans and livestock on this planet, because nature has only a finite resource, a natural resource. And we're using up that natural resource quicker than we're replacing it.
I've seen quite a lot of arguments around on both sides, you know, people saying that environmentalists shouldn't have kids or along those sorts of lines because of the population problem. However, the counterpoint is if we used our resources more wisely, then we would be able to sustain far more people than we actually have currently. It's just we use very inefficient systems.
And of course, we have an awful lot of livestock that take up an
somehow we feed 80 billion land animals, but we can't feed 8 billion people.
Yeah.
That's
an episode in its own right, that one.
Yeah.
So anyway, as far as her reason for hope is, those are the reasons that she thinks that human intellect ultimately will solve and has to solve and restore the damage that we're doing. And I'll go on to this a bit later on, but the underlying feeling in this book is that she seriously believes there is a changing viewpoint around the world. It's gradually changing. People are coming on board. Corporations are coming on board. Well, governments mean,
without,
are coming on board.
Always relating this back to, obviously, the part of the environment sector that I work in, being rivers and water pollution, is, okay, a lot of the stats that are out there are pretty grim, but it's undeniable that that topic of water pollution and rivers and that sort of thing, is and coasts as well, is in the news and being talked about way more than it ever has done before. Yeah. And that is because people around, obviously I'm speaking very UK-focused here, people around the country are becoming aware of the problems and becoming passionate about trying to solve them.
Yeah.
And that interest or that knowledge wasn't necessarily there 50 or 60 years ago. And so...
And as much as she talks about the fact that, you know, the planet is, we're not in good shape, we're not in a good way, the underlying feeling is that things are changing and changing on a big scale, actually, in the way that awareness is being created for the fact that if we don't do something soon, and we have to do something soon, the hope is that we take action now. We have to do it now.
Obviously, it's not going to be one action. It's a whole bunch of lots of actions, some small, some big, that will come together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've really liked this reference that she made, that every individual has an impact on the planet every single day of their lives, in what they choose to eat, what they choose to buy, what they choose to tip down the sink, whatever it may be. You have an impact on the planet every single day of your life. So if making a small change, if billions of people realise that they're making an impact on the planet every single day and they make a small change, it has a huge effect.
Yeah, we've spoken about it in a few of our episodes, things that don't focus necessarily on a species but on a different topic like tea or coffee, where, okay, one person using loose leaf tea won't change the world, but if every tea drinker across the world stops using plastic tea bags, that makes a difference.
Yeah.
Same with, I don't know, coffee filters and all sorts of things like that, where it's sometimes perhaps disheartening, you know, trying to buy your plastic-free tea bags when you then, I don't know, have a delivery and everything's wrapped in plastic.
Yeah.
You know, is there any point? But if everybody takes small actions, the accumulative effect can be massive.
Absolutely, and it can be, it's not necessarily even... you know, an environmental thing. It can be something about animal welfare. So if you choose to buy a beauty product and you then choose to buy one that is not tested on animals, if we all do that, then that has a huge effect.
Yeah.
So, or if you decide not to buy that cheap bit of clothing because the company is using slave labour, you know, and exploiting child labour and stuff like that, those little changes, those little decisions that you make,
it's tricky,
has a massive effect, you know.
It is hard because I also understand people who don't like the consumer first campaigns, because people will view it as taking away some of the pressure or ownership on the corporations, for example.
Yeah.
So campaigns that push the public to, I don't know, say buy plastic free drinks, other people argue, well, really you should be campaigning for the drinks companies to stop using plastic.
Yeah.
So there's two sides, but I like a mixture, because I feel like the need to recognize the importance of individual action gives us that hope.
Yeah.
Otherwise we are facing a monumental challenge and it can be quite hard to find the hope. So I think I can understand people who don't want to see individual action being the focus of a campaign, because it will push the people who are causing the problems. But I think change has to come from both directions.
Yeah.
And I think more than anything, it is a good source of hope, thinking, you know, if we all do this and we all come together, we can make a difference.
Yeah.
And I think that is almost as important.
Yeah, because you're right. And again, she's not just concentrating on each individual, but she is concentrating too, or making reference to the fact that the way big corporations work, government works, you know, we all have to.
Yeah.
It has to be a change on both sides, definitely.
And to be fair, you could argue that, I don't know, if you've got a company that sells glass bottles and plastic bottles and every individual only bought the glass bottles, the company would stop making the plastic bottles.
Yeah, yeah,
so
definitely.
It does go both ways.
So that's her reasoning for the fact that the amazing human intellect she hopes will ultimately restore the planet and restore the environment. And so you've got some examples
I went slightly different.
Not referenced in this book, because obviously you haven't read the book.
Not yet, so. No. I took it to mean, you've spoken a bit about technology, but I took it to mean, like, look at some of the incredible technological advancements that are going on currently to try and help us tackle the problem of climate change. I've got a few, and I won't go through all of them.
Yeah.
And I'll go through them quickly, because otherwise... Again,
yeah, we've got a lot to get through.
It could have been an entire episode just on technological advancements. But just for a few that I thought were quite cool, we've seen obviously a lot at the moment about flooding and drought becoming both of those becoming more prevalent and severe. And there's I think it came from a company in the Netherlands that creates something called smart roofs or smart rooftops.
Yeah.
And it's essentially an innovation that tackles heat and rainfall by capturing water in a special layer on flat rooftops. Now, I couldn't actually find what that special layer was, so I don't know whether they've sort of kept that under wrap or not.
Yeah.
But essentially what it means is when it rains really heavily, they capture the water, and it's a really clever like system of the way it stores it on a rooftop. And then when it becomes a drought situation, that water's then available and it can be siphoned essentially into the pipeworks and sorted for use of people, also keeping the rooftop cool. And it also acts as somewhere that supports a rooftop garden as well, which then means you can grow plants, which then continues to cool down cities.
And also attracts invertebrates and...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it almost acts like a rooftop wetland, so combating drought and flooding, which I thought was pretty cool. Yeah. One of the ones I really liked was robot jellyfish.
Okay, tell me more.
It's being designed by researchers at University of Southampton and Edinburgh, which I thought was cool because it's local to me. And essentially they are exactly what it sounds like. It's a robot jellyfish, but they explore endangered coral reefs and undertake tasks that would be too delicate for human divers to do without causing some level of disturbance. So some of it's just observing and trying to work out, you know, species down there and the health and the state of the corals. But some of it's even like restoration stuff. So planting the little, I can't remember what they're called. They've got a word or a name, little things that then start off artificial corals and all sorts of things like that. So you've got these little robotic jellyfish doing the work that divers might cause too much sort of disruption.
So the amazing human intellect, the part of our brain that reasons and solves problems. Yeah. So that's...
I just thought was brilliant.
Yeah, I like that.
Actually, off at the top of the like green rooftops, green construction in general, we've spoken about swift bricks and bat bricks.
Yeah.
You've got the green walls.
Yes.
So you can grow plants on the outside of trees to
actually, do you know, I saw one of those where... Mum and I were driving somewhere. I can't remember where it was. I think it was when we went up to Colchester, and we saw a whole industrial building with a green wall, and it looked incredible.
It's really clever because, obviously, apart from the fact that the plants help cool down cities, massive home for invertebrates, feed the birds.
But I say I've seen green roofs, but I've never seen green walls.
They're really cool.
Not on that, not that size anyway, because it was huge.
We've also touched on vertical farming before, but the idea of being able to grow plants really efficiently in a city reduces the need for herbicides and pesticides, normally uses less land and less water. Apparently, quite an advanced one's just opened up in Gloucestershire.
Oh, okay.
And they're growing, what are they growing? They're growing like lettuce, basil, herbs, all sorts of things, which means that apart from the fact that those crops are then available year-round, they don't need to be imported. Which again cuts down travel costs. The only caveat to vertical farming at the moment is they do use quite a lot of electric power.
Right, okay.
Depending on the sustainability of the grid, obviously changes the sustainability aspect, but with rising energy prices, some of them are struggling.
That's the
flip side. And I've got two more quick ones. Plant-based meat, it's obviously close to our hearts being vegans.
Yeah.
But the stats really are quite fascinating. Like the plant-based meats have an average of 50% lower environmental impact. Some have 77% less impact than something like beef. Lower water usage, lower land use. An Impossible Burger causes 11% of the emissions that would come from beef. It's also 57% more sustainable than pork and 37% more sustainable than chicken. But the point being that as technology advances, not only are they becoming slightly cheaper, they're becoming, you know, better as far as taste and nutrition and everything like that.
Yeah, well, we've noticed that over the last few years as well, haven't we?
There's different opinions. Some vegans would rather just eat like whole plant foods rather than something which would technically be slightly more processed, like plant-based meat. However, I think it's undeniable in the role they play of bringing non-vegans over to eating more plant. Even if they don't go vegan, people are more likely to, I don't know, let's try the McPlant from McDonald's. Yes. If that option isn't there, then it's not there. So the fact that the technology is getting better means that hopefully more people are willing to try them and they can start cutting back. And the impact on land is mental. I mean, quick stat being that animal agriculture is responsible for 18% of all of our greenhouse emissions, which is more than all transportation combined, which is about 13%.
Yeah. Well, I haven't mentioned the fact in a couple of references in the book that Jane Goodall says one of the major ways that we can certainly help to save the planet is to gravitate over to a plant-based diet.
Obviously, you spoke about everybody having an impact every single day. That's something that we do a minimum normally of 3 times a day is what we eat.
Yeah.
So that's 3 big choices that can be made. So it's a good way. So
even if you don't, you're not cutting meat out completely.
Not that we're biased.
Just reducing the amount of meat and dairy that you consume will make a difference.
And then the last one, because I think this one's sometimes controversial, but there's some stuff going on which I wasn't aware about, which is fascinating, is AI. And obviously some people are quite nervous about AI and stuff like that, but some of the ways it's being used fascinating. I'm not going to go into it again, could be an entire episode, maybe it should be from using machine learning to analyze ice surfaces, to using it to build models to work out the most effective places for us to plant new forests for carbon capture.
We've
got early warning systems to detecting algal blooms that will be damaging to environments that
that's
then
using
be
AI in a fantastic way.
So you've got remote
it?
Sensors and it essentially builds a model based on historical data. I'm not going to pretend I really understand how it works. But yeah, they're using it to literally work out, right, where's the most efficient place for us to plant trees? What's actually happening to the ice surfaces and how can we predict what's going to happen in the future?
And of course, AI is moving at a pace that is quite frightening at the moment. Isn't
I think it's, as always in the media, it's always portrayed in quite a bad way.
Well, I think it's portrayed because people think ultimately it's going to take over
their
jobs.
It's going to be Skynet as well.
And they're all going to lose their jobs. They're not going to be needed anymore.
Yeah, and the Terminator's going to come.
But
the fact is that there are some really, really clever ways that AI is being used for the benefit of the planet.
Yeah, that's the key thing. I think that's a key point.
So I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, I like that.
But maybe,
those are good
that AI
examples
should probably be an episode, I think.
I think it'll make a really good episode, actually.
We have to pretend we understand how AI works.
Well, of course we do.
I just ask ChatGPT stuff.
Well, just ask Adam, he'll tell you.
That's my brother, by the way.
Yeah.
On to the next reason for hope.
We'll go on to the next reason for hope, which is the resilience of nature. We've touched on this quite a few times, actually, when we've talked about places like the Nep Estate and Wild Ken Hill, fantastic rewilding projects, which have sort of highlighted just how, if you leave nature alone, it will recover so quickly.
Yeah, and if you go back and listen to our first episode of the year, I think, which was like the positive news from 2023.
Yeah.
We had examples like corals that are adapting to higher temperatures and even, you know, they're famously temperature sensitive, but there are examples now of them being resilient to bleaching and stuff like that.
I mean, in this book, and again, I implore you all to go and read this book. So I'm not going to reel off all the examples in there because actually that's a bit of a spoiler if you're going to go and read the book. And I really do encourage you to read it because it's a real feel-good book. But there's some great examples in there. For example, there were 2 500-year-old camphor trees in Nagasaki that were right in the middle of the fireball of the atomic bomb that was set off there. Temperatures reached 1,000,000 degrees. Temperature of the sun, you know. So
which, just to point out, the incredible human intellect built that bomb.
Yeah, incredible human intellect did that destruction. However, these two trees were completely scorched. Only half of the trees were left, scorched, and there wasn't a single leaf on the tree, but the trees were alive somehow. They were still alive and they recovered.
That's funny. I've got a very similar example coming up.
And every spring now, they have new shoots, new leaves, and they're a real, you know, icon of how resilient nature is. It's how incredible capacity to survive and regenerate and restore if you leave it alone, and it will do its thing. Nature is incredible. I thought that was a fantastic example.
Actually, can I hop in then with my example?
You're going to do the 9/11 tree?
No.
Oh, okay.
I was going to hop in with Chernobyl.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good one.
Which, obviously, massive nuclear disaster.
Yeah.
But nature has reclaimed it. And so that area is still not fit for humans because of the level of radiation.
Top Gear did an episode where they actually drove through, but they were in bloody Hamsat suits. Yeah, they had the
Geiger counter going.
Yeah.
Now in the area, you've got wolves, boars, bears, horses that all live there to a level that's similar, if not better, than other nature reserves.
Because there's no human intervention.
Because there's no humans. Yeah. But the Red Forest, which is a dense woodland of about 4 to 6 square kilometres, actually turned orange and died as the radiation swept over the area, and it essentially became a wasteland. Within 30 years, the forest has almost completely regenerated.
Wow.
Silver birch has actually colonised in the place of the pines, and apparently a recent drone revealed that areas that still have massive, massive radiation are full of trees, grasses and other plants, and wildlife levels are actually higher there than pre-disaster. So obviously, I'm not saying Chernobyl was a good thing. I'm not saying that at all.
No, but it's a great example of how nature, if you leave it alone.
It also shows our impact. It's the wildlife in that area has bounced back from nuclear disaster to a higher level than when we were there, which shows our impact in comparison to radiation levels.
Yeah, that's a great example.
But the fact that the forest literally turned red and burnt away, and 30 years later you've got a thriving forest with
still not,
wolves and
it's
boars.
Still not safe for human population.
It's incredible,
it?
But again, just a remarkable example of the fact that wildlife and nature will come back.
Yeah, there was another tree, they call it the survivor tree, actually, at 9/11, which was completely crushed under two massive concrete blocks, and there was only half the trunk left. It had all been scarred, all the roots were broken, and they were going to trash it. And a young horticulturist begged them to let her take it away and nurture it, and she did. And she nurtured it back to life, and now it is, I think they've replanted it in Ground Zero.
Oh, that's
and it blossoms
as well.
Every year, and again, it's that sort of, that sort of symbol of hope.
Yeah. I just want to really emphasise that I was not implying that Chernobyl was good for the planet.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The lasting impact it's had on human health and everything has been absolutely horrendous. It was just an example of wildlife coming back.
Well, I think the great example from the book that really did, inspired me that there is hope, is it talks about a disused quarry, a cement quarry in Kenya, and it was 500 acres. That have been everything under on the ground had been crushed by machinery and whatever. There wasn't anything, nothing grew there, and it was disused because they completely taken everything out of the ground that was there to be taken. The restoration project was actually initiated by the CEO and the owner of the company, who looked at it and thought, it's our obligation to restore that area because it's so awful what we've done. So he employed a horticulturist called René Haller and gave him the job of restoring it. And it seemed an impossible task because literally nothing grew. So he found a species of, like a pioneer species of tree. It was called the Casuarina. It doesn't mean anything to me. And it's a tree that's been widely used in restoration projects because it's very hardy and will grow pretty much anywhere. So he got seedlings of those and he tried to grow them. But what he discovered is that the leaves of this tree wouldn't decompose on the ground. There was no sort of soil, there was no humus
or anything like that.
But what he did notice, and you'll like this, is that beautiful little millipedes were eagerly chewing up the needles of this tree, and their droppings were creating humus and enriching this bare earth.
Yeah.
So he had hundreds of them collected from all of the surrounding area, and over time that created a layer of fertile humus, which then it started to
regenerate,
fertilise the soil, and other plant species started to grow. And then over the 10 years, the original trees that he planted had grown to 30 metres. The soil layer was now thick enough to support 180 species of indigenous trees and plants. Various birds, insects and animals began returning to the land, and it's now known as Haller Park and is visited from people all over the world to come and see what a restoration project
That's
what
really
can
cool.
be done.
We should do a podcast trip there.
And it's a fantastic example of a of a CEO of a massive company that's destroyed the environment saying, you know, we've got to do something about that. We've done that. We need to do something about that. And so that's a really, that was a really good cool. example. So, you know, there are, I could reel off dozens of examples of the resilience of nature, but I think, again, the underlying message of this chapter was just, if we rewild, if we give nature the time and the space and leave it alone, it will restore the planet and areas of the planet on its own, and we need to do that. I think the underlying feeling was that the awareness of that is growing, and there are companies now that are, and big corporations that are realising that when they do a development, they have to include, you know, areas of wild, of rewilding and green space. And of course, it's been, you know, in this country, there's been a law that's been brought in about this 10% net gain for biodiversity in all planning applications.
Again, now, we've spoken about before, and it's a tricky thing to calculate.
It's a tricky thing, but it is there in a law now that every development has to prove
there's some
that
net
they've
gain.
Net gained the biodiversity through creating green space, ponds, lakes, planting trees, whatever it may be. So there is a growing awareness that we have to create new wetlands, new areas of green space, new waterways, all of those things to help nature to let it then do its thing. And then nature will do its thing if we let it. So there's a great chapter all about that. And that is her hope, is that nature will restore quickly if you let it.
Yeah.
We've destroyed vast amounts of the planet. We've taken apparently 50% of the world's forests and trees we've taken down, but they'll restore really quickly if we
give them space.
Allow them to.
Yeah,
you know?
I to be honest, Chernobyl was my main example. I had other things like we've spoken before about migratory birds changing the time of their migration to adapt to climate change. I've got an example of great tits now laying their eggs earlier to adapt with the emergence of their favourite food, which is like a species of caterpillar. But more than to keep this really short, there's actually an incredible, like, I think, I don't know whether it was a full art project, but it's like an art portfolio of photos called Reclaimed by Nature. And it's abandoned places that have then been reclaimed by nature.
Yeah.
And they don't really work without the photos. So I will link to the bottom. There's also, people are on Reddit. There's a brilliant Reddit subreddit called Reclaimed by Nature. It's people taking photos of like trees growing through roads and stuff like that. But the one example I'll read about was Spree Park in Germany, which was an abandoned theme park. It closed in 2001, and it is literally now just like a forest.
Wow.
And it looks like something out of The Walking Dead. But it's just incredible how quickly.
I say it doesn't take any time.
Closed
at
in
all.
2001. I don't know when the photo was taken, but it's less than.
Yeah.
It wasn't super recent, so it's less than 20 years, and the entire thing is now like a forest. So I will leave a link to Reclaimed by Nature, and people can just go and watch. As soon as people move out. It's just incredible how quickly nature bounces
back. Well, I talk
back.
About, you know, on a slightly different level, I talk about Medmri, which is on the south coast, which was one of the largest coastal realignment schemes in Europe, actually. But how quickly, I mean, they dug channels and banks and they let the seawater in to create wetlands. And within, I think they did it in 2014, by 2015 they got, you know, nesting curlews, and they got avocets in, and the wildlife just came in so quickly. It was greening over, the reed beds had started to grow, nature came in, and that was just within a year of that happening.
Yeah, it can be so quick.
So nature will restore really quickly if you let it. I'm not sure whether the ice flow will, but it will do if we get the temperatures down. But
yeah, I think the main thing with that is just trying to reduce the speed at which the temperatures are rising and trying to mitigate that more than anything.
Yeah, anyway, that's another story. So, the incredible resilience of nature is a reason for hope.
I like the next one. Next one's good.
So the third one we go on is the power of young people. And while she was working out in Tanzania and in Africa, she had a 12 Tanzanian high school students came to her talking about how worried they were about the destruction of the coral reefs by illegal dynamiting and poaching that was going on, and the destruction of the land around them. And they didn't know what to do, what they could do about it. And she started with this little group. she started Roots and Shoots. And they started off litter picking on the beaches.
Yeah,
and
nice.
They got a huge amount of abuse for that because they were doing it for free. And people were saying, why are you doing that for free? But they carried on doing all these things. And then gradually they started planting trees and Roots and Shoots was born. And it took off in such a way. It became an educational, environmental and humanitarian program. And it's now a global movement. She found that other young people in Africa were coming to her in from different areas and saying, can we start our own Roots and Shoots? And it's now in 70 countries.
That's incredible. I also have a really cool example of a young African kid doing something that I know you'll love.
Yeah, so, and she's now, this Roots and Shoots has grown, like I say, to such a global presence. And it's encouraging young people of all ages. They've gone on to, from kindergarten to become university students, to become professional people working, you know, in the world, not necessarily being able to change the world, but they are the people that will be voting for the people that can change the world,
yeah.
You know. So,
and also, you know, they might be doing the research, developing,
and they've become activists, they're planting trees, protecting forests, picking up litter on beaches. They also, she was really encouraging and empowering girls and women in Africa as well, of course, who didn't have so many rights to speak and rights to, you know, to get up and, or thought they didn't have the right to get up and have a voice. And so she'd really encouraged girls to have a voice. And then it spread. There was other groups, you know, in, let's say, across all countries that came to her and wanted to start their own groups, and it spread. And there are other examples I can give. There's a young climate activist called Genesis Butler in America. She became vegan at 6. She started an animal rights and climate movement called the Youth Climate Save. And that has now spread. There are 73 Youth Climate Save chapters in 22 countries. And it's packed with, she says, energetic and passionate youth that are committed to making a difference, particularly when it comes to climate-related issues and also animal welfare. So there's this real growing, you know, movement of youngsters wanting to, I mean, obviously Greta Thunberg is a classic example.
Yeah, she's probably the famous one, isn't she?
So that's the power of young people. They are aware. You know,
yeah.
We don't think they are, but they are. They're really aware. And they're actually, many of them, Greta Thunberg being a classic example, is really, really, I'm going to use the word, pissed off by what we've done to the planet.
Yeah, and I think we've seen
our generation, my generation, not yours necessarily, but my generation has done to the planet and we continue to do to the planet.
So, yeah, and I think we've seen, and again, you can argue the effectiveness of the COPs, but we've seen a lot more young people having a voice at
having
the COPs,
a voice.
And a lot of it is, or does come from a point of anger or desperation or just concern.
Yeah.
Just, you know, this is the world that they're growing up in and they really want to make sure that they can do something, but that the people who are currently in power recognise the need to do something.
And it's about empowering young people and giving them a voice. And if you do that, you know, they are ultimately the people that they're going to grow up and save the world. And, you know, so we need to educate and empower them.
Even back to things like finally having natural history as a GCSE and sort of getting people young people involved in the natural world from an earlier age. I can't remember the quote. David Attenborough has a very famous quote that I keep seeing on social media about if kids aren't exposed to nature from a young age, how will they ever really appreciate the value of it and come to say so, that the importance of having
absolutely
having
Dr. Jane
exposure.
Goodall said that children spend far too much time sitting on a chair in a classroom when they should actually be out experiencing and embracing the natural world.
Yes.
And so it's exactly the same thing, isn't it? So,
I have a couple of cool examples.
Yeah, please do.
This. One example, actually I've got two from the UK. One is a pair of sisters, Ella and Amy Meek, who started Kids Against Plastic.
Oh, right.
They're two sisters fighting against plastic pollution and waste in the UK. They started Kids Against Plastic in 2016 at the ages of 10 and 12 and have since picked up more than 100,000 pieces of single-use plastic. They've launched campaign initiatives with schools to get schools involved in litter picking. They've worked with cafes, businesses and festivals and even published a book called Be Plastic Clever, which I thought was quite cool.
That's great, yeah, I like that.
The example I thought you'd really love comes from Kenya, from a teenager who, I'm really sorry if I get the pronunciation wrong, Leeson Mutunki. Again, I probably have pronounced that incorrectly. Essentially, passionate about the planet, really concerned about pollution and deforestation around his area in Kenya, but also has a real passion for football.
He started
Trees for Goals. Yeah. And essentially, when he was 12 years old, he founded Trees for Goals with a simple mission. He would plant 11 trees every time he scores a goal. Fortunately, he's pretty good at football, and he's so far planted more than 1,000 trees.
That's amazing.
And he's now going through the efforts, and obviously he's older now, trying to encourage other schools and football clubs to get involved. And so 11 trees was one for each of his teammates. Every time he scores a goal, he's got to go and plant 11 trees.
I love that.
And he's trying to get schools involved so that during football matches, you take the tally and then you put it into a planting scheme, or you actually get out and plant it.
That's such a good idea.
In general, and essentially, yeah, he's actually attended climate conferences around the world, and he's trying to expand his campaign into other areas of Africa. But I just saw one incredible combination of football and environmentalism.
I love that.
And it's just a good job he's good at scoring goals, really.
You'd send me the link to
it. It wouldn't have been quite so good if he was a goalkeeper.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was such a creative way of getting people interested in the environment. And just very briefly, you mentioned like youth organisations, but there is one in the UK called UK Youth for Nature, who I've had some contact with, and they're absolutely brilliant. And
have you've had contact with them in respect of the Rivers Trust?
We ran an event with them, and so I've been on Zoom calls with some of the people involved in the UK Youth for Nature, and they are just incredibly passionate and a brilliant organisation. Essentially, their mission is to, I'll read it from their website, mobilise and empower young people to seek and call for decisive action on nature and wildlife in the UK. And essentially, they are platforming and uniting youth voices, training the next generation of environmental leaders. And their ultimate vision is to increase the visibility of nature in all decision making, and sort of it's very surrounding sort of political awareness and campaigning for political change. But they are just a fantastic organisation.
But that's what we've said earlier on, isn't it? Is that you need to that politics, the political change is what becomes law. So.
Yeah, and I think I'll admit that I was not interested in politics at all from a young age.
Yeah.
I sort of ignored it. The only thing that really brought me into the political world was actually Brexit. It was the first time I sort of sat up and was like, okay, I need to take notice now. And since then, I've just tried to become a lot more educated in it, apart from the fact it plays a role now in my job.
Of course, yeah.
But it's one of those things where, I was in university before I really started taking any notice of politics. And it's so crucial. And so empowering young people to take that. I always had an interest in nature, never associated it with politics.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important that people work out or learn or are empowered to understand how they can make change actually happen from a younger age. And UK Youth for Nature are
really
one of those
point.
Organisations. And again, I'll link to them in the show notes, but they are just a fantastic group of people.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, she's got massive hope because of the power of young people.
And there are some incredibly passionate young people out
there. And again, I keep mentioning it, but the underlying theme of it all is that the movement is growing and the awareness is growing and young people are really, really
stepping up
and want to make change, and they have to make change, and they're the people that are going to save the planet. So that's a great thing. So I loved that chapter. You can find out so much about the roots and shoots and Genesis Butler. I recommend you have a look on her site. She's got a really cool website, actually. I really like it.
Yeah, I mean,
and she was highlighted in a Marvel comic episode as well.
Oh, that's cool.
So it's really cool.
Actually, on that, just a really quick shout out as well. Even people like the three engineers, who again I've worked with through the Rivers Trust, but they have created the character Scout, and she's a brilliant, almost like Dora the Explorer type character. But her mission is they go around schools with three books. I think they've got three so far, trying to get kids from a much really young age, like primary school level, interested in litter picking stuff through a relatable, brilliant character and rhyming books. And again, it's that all these people out there creating really beautiful products and finding new and creative ways to inspire and get people interested in it and expose them to the issues.
Yeah.
They've got one on rivers and they've got one on litter, and these are all topics that maybe kids wouldn't have been aware of without a nice cartoon character.
Yeah, and when you think, you know, there are kids, you know, of today that will be the politicians of tomorrow. Yeah. So, you know, that's the key.
There's
isn't
stuff
it?
Going on.
It's great.
Everywhere.
Yeah, it's really good. Anyway, we'll go on to the last one because this is going to be a long episode.
It's funny because before this we were like, this might not be a very long episode.
And the last one is the indomitable human spirit. And that, if you want a definition of that, that's the quality that makes us tackle the seemingly impossible and never give up. You know, despite the odds, despite the scorn and mocking from people sometimes, despite the possibility of failure, people have this indomitable human spirit to never give up and to achieve a goal, and that's what gives her great hope. And there are lots of examples of that again in the book. But it tends to be those, you know, she highlights those people that are willing to sort of risk imprisonment and torture and even death to resist, you know, tyranny and injustice and prejudice. And so that indomitable human spirit gives her massive hope that we will prevail, because there are people out there that will face up and will not be afraid to speak out and will not be afraid to campaign and never give up. And she cites, for example, things like the indigenous people in South America who fight government and big business defending their lands from logging and mining, and they're prepared to sacrifice their lives, and often do, to stop those things happening.
It could actually, again, I have to add this because in researching and trying to find things for the human spirit, and again, I won't go into all my examples after your bit, because it would go on forever.
Yeah.
But the amount of information of indigenous people working hard to conserve potentially more land than all of our like national parks and stuff combined, and they're so easily overlooked because you don't read about them. But there are people really fighting very hard. And we probably should do an episode on the power of these indigenous people protecting their local land and working with their local land.
This is why this book resonated so much with me, because I think we can do episodes.
Just farming it for content.
Yeah. Episodes that relate to all of these topics, because, as I say, it resonated with me because we always talk about hope and it's a huge thing. But there's some great examples. I'm only going to do one, because this one is such a lovely story, incredible story. It came from one of her visits to China, and it was two boyhood friends. They've been friends since they were boys in a small rural village in China. One of them was blind in one eye from birth, and then as an adult he lost the sight in his other eye due to a factory accident. And the other friend had lost both his arms at the age of three from touching a live rail.
Oh, blimey.
So he'd lost both of his arms. But they grew up as real good friends. But when they got into adulthood, the one that lost his sight in a factory accident became really depressed. And so his friend sort of realised he had to do something to help his spirit and tried to come up with an idea of how they could find some purpose in life. And they're both in their 30s by now. And before the guy lost his sight, they talked a lot about the fact that their local village was being degraded so badly by a local quarry that has polluted the rivers, killed the fish and the wildlife, lots of industrial emissions all around that polluted the air. And they were getting really disenchanted by that. So he came up with the idea, guy who got no arms came up with the idea of planting trees to try and help regenerate his local village. And the blind man said, well, it's an impossible task. How do we do that? How does a blind man and an armless man do that? It's impossible. But he came up with the answer, and the answer was that he would be his friend's sight and his friend would be his arms. And they couldn't afford to buy plants and everything, so they decided to propagate from local, take cuttings. So they literally, he was the eyes and the other guy was the arms, and they started to take cuttings and propagate trees. And the first seedlings didn't do very well because they couldn't get enough water, but they didn't give up, that indomitable human spirit, and they found a way. And over the time now, and they were mocked and scorned by the local villagers who said, you'll never do it, it's ridiculous, it's impossible. They've now planted and regenerated 10,000 trees. There was a documentary done, filmed about them. There's a fantastic image in the book of the guy with the sight leading the guy with no arms to the places where they would get the cuttings and the trees. And it
That's
was
really
just,
cool.
It's just a fantastic story.
Yeah.
What it doesn't say in there, what was the name of the documentary? Because I'm going to have to go and find that and watch
it.
That and see if I can find that documentary. But it's a really incredible story of indomitable human spirit. There are lots in there.
So go
you know, she
book.
Goes back. She has remembering the Second World War and the incredible human spirit in London, for example, that was bombed pretty much constantly, and how people got together and got through it. And the indomitable human spirit gives her hope that we'll never give up trying to save the planet. We'll never give up trying to empower people and save the environment and animal welfare, look after the animals. So the indomitable human spirit, it's an incredible thing, actually. You've just mentioned someone who's just run the whole length
Russ
of Africa.
Cook, the hardest geezer. Yeah.
And he's literally run from one end of Africa to the other through some of the most unbelievable...
Yeah, robbed at gunpoint.
Unbelievable hardship to do it.
Yeah, food poisoning, their van broke down, I think, almost every day at that point. And he's, for almost an entire year has run, so I can't remember the number, like 328 marathons, 16 or 19 million steps.
So you've got to have indomitable human spirit to get through that. All right, I know that's not,
Well, I mean,
it is because it shows you what is possible if you don't give up
and
you believe in something.
And he really struggled, to get the money and the sponsorship because people told him it was just ridiculous to run the entire length of Africa. But he did it, and what a legend.
Yeah, anyway, there are numerous examples. I could, do a whole episode on it, which I'm not going to, but it's the principle that we have this indomitable human spirit, this seemingly never give up attitude.
Yeah, and I think so. I've got two very quick examples. One being, again, sorry for the pronunciation if this is incorrect, Niambi Morris, who's a Ugandan activist who's faced quite a lot of struggles whilst campaigning for climate justice. He's been physically threatened, had his phone confiscated, he's had equipment taken from him. He actually had his Twitter account suspended after a TV appearance that he made where he opposed industrial logging in his area, and so they suspended his account. And he is still out there fighting for free speech, mainly, so that people can stand up and make speech, as well as planting trees and tackling plastic waste. And then one quite recent one, actually. So a group of four women, I think they're all over 64, I think, as well. So from a different spectrum of age this time, filed a lawsuit before the Europe's top human rights court against the country of Switzerland for violating their rights by not protecting them from the health impacts of climate change, because the country did not fulfil its pledge to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 20% by 2020 compared to the 1990 levels. I think they made it something like... it's either 7 or 11%, but they didn't hit that goal.
Yeah.
And so you've got four people being like, well, we're going to take the country to court then, which, again, is such an underdog story that you think people would tell you that it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like,
you'll never do
it.
What are you doing? Yeah.
And yet on Tuesday, I think of this week just gone, the court decided in their favour, making it the first time an international court has ever ruled on a government's legal obligations regarding climate change. So essentially, there's... people aren't too sure what the outfall is going to be, but one of the things that people are pleased about is it, for the first time, recognises that governments have a human rights obligation when it comes to climate change. And it's not just, oh, we should probably try and save the trees. It's actually a human health issue as well. And it's the first time that's been recognised in an international court.
That's a really big thing, isn't
it? And you've got four people being like, we're taking the country to court. They haven't made their goal, and let's hold them accountable. And it's actually been ruled in their favour, which is just a...
yeah.
I think if anybody was around the pub and they were like, let's take the country to court, people are like, you've had one too many there. And it's just, it's a bit of a landmark case.
Well, I was going to say, that is a landmark case, isn't it?
Yeah, and, I just thought it was again, an example of people willing to take on what would seem...
What's nice
be...
about that, those landmark cases then are always referenced in the next case.
Yeah.
They could say, well, actually...
it's like, for the first time something's being recognised, they can't really go back on that now.
No.
So
that's a great story.
Yeah, I think it's taken, obviously, a long time, as court proceedings always seem to. But I'm pretty sure it was this Tuesday that it's actually, the court has ruled in their favour. Four people taking on a country.
Yeah, fantastic.
Incredible.
So yeah, so that's really the four reasons for hope.
With some nice examples of each.
With some nice examples. And what I loved about this book, and I do really do urge you to read this book, because it is really uplifting and really encouraging. And one of the things that she says is that, you know, we don't hear enough good news stories like these in the press and the media and social media. We just hear of all the bad stuff most of the time. But there are so many examples of people fighting to save the planet and fighting for animal welfare and people's rights.
And it's great because it varies from kids in schools picking up plastic on the beach to people taking a country to court.
And it's... I think what she also, what also resonated with me was that she was talking about what you need to do is tell stories. And through this book, she tells stories that then sort of tugged at people's heartstrings most of the time and actually made people listen. You know, all these fantastic stories, that some of which, you know, examples that we've given in this episode.
Also, when we spoke about it, like the reason why I liked it, obviously I haven't read the book yet, but the sort of fire it's lit under you, it's obviously a fire that was already there, the sort of motivation and passion.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it's then led to a whole podcast episode, but the conversation we had on the phone where you sort of pitched the idea of the episode, you could tell how much the book had resonated.
Really affected me, really did.
And what it's sort of what it meant to you, and I think that just highlights the power of books and the power of writing.
Yeah.
Like I've mentioned it before, you know, I gave you a book and that was a big part in your decision to become vegan. I think the power of stories and words and books
is the power of stories,
and it's something, there's nothing better than reading a book and finishing it just thinking, bloody hell, that's just,
well, to be honest,
blown my mind.
As you know, I haven't stopped talking about Jane Goodall since I read the book, and yeah, I do. I absolutely urge you to.
Yeah, I think it's a really, without being like an emotional thing, I think it's a wonderful thing to find a book that can have such an impact on you. And so hopefully it will have an impact on other people out there as well.
What I also find amazing is this lady is 90 years of age and she's out there now campaigning.
Still going.
Lecturing, educating, nurturing her roots and shoots, projects out there, empowering young people. What an incredible lady. I was totally and utterly inspired by her. Dr. Jane Goodall, you are an absolute hero of mine now. Definitely. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. I hope that gives you hope, because it certainly gives me hope.
Yeah, and if nothing else, it's certainly provided a teaser of follow-up episodes, because we've now got all sorts of things we want to talk about.
Yeah, definitely. It will definitely lead on to more episodes that relate to the, you know, what we've talked about today.
We said it before, and we'll stop rambling in a minute. We always talk about highlighting the good stuff, but we've done, if you like, the positive news that we do each year.
Yeah.
There's something very nice about for taking a break just to look at good stuff.
Yeah.
So hopefully this has been another example of an episode that focuses on the positives.
Yeah. And we'll put, as ever, we'll put all the links and...
I'll stick a link to the book and all sorts. And
buy it, read it, audio book it, and listen to her podcast. She does an amazing podcast called The Hope Cast. And I was lying in the bath listening to one last night. So I've got a little bit obsessed with Dr. Jane Goodall. She's she's my new hero. And she's incredible. And I'm going to stop whittling now.
All right, well, so thank you very much.
Yeah, catch you next time.
It's going to be a short one. It's been a long one, but hopefully you have enjoyed it. Thanks for listening.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye.